Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today has been on Church and Culture a number of times. Bill Donahue is the president of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights, the nation's largest Catholic civil rights organization. He's very well known through his books, including Why Catholicism Matters, The Catholic Advantage. And he's coming on the show today to talk about a wonderful, and I'm going to call it a little book, and that is Praise, from Sophia Institute Press, entitled Unmasking Mother Teresa's Critics. Bill Donahue, welcome to Church and Culture once again.
Thank you so much, Dale. Thank you.
I want to start with the title. And by the way, I want to tell our listeners, this little book from Sophia Press is about 100 pages. And as I just told Bill before we got on the call, if you can't say what you want to say in 100 pages, you don't know what you're talking about. Bill, did you aim to write a little book, or is that just how it turned out?
I'll tell you the truth, Dale. You know, I've had a lot to deal with Mother Teresa over the years, fighting with Christopher Hitchens. We'll
right.
get to him in a minute. And then having a demonstration in the street outside the Empire State Building. You were there and spoke. So I thought, well, the canonization is coming up the Sunday of Labor Day weekend. I knew that, around Christmas time. And I decided over the winter, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do a little research and put together a booklet. And it began to grow. And I thought, well, I wonder if it's a little bit too big for a booklet. I don't know if it's big enough for a book, but let it run by one of my publishers, the guy I deal with, and they said, well, listen, we already got a book on Mother Teresa coming out with Father Brian, the postulator. So I contacted Charlie McKinney over at Sophia. Mm-hmm. They've asked me before if I'm interested in writing. I said, listen, time is of the essence. It's a
right.
book. Are you interested? And he says, I am. So
good for him.
Quite frankly, I think the final straw for me was reading this article by these Canadian professors 3 years ago in a scientific journal, which I had translated from the French for me. And then I found not only did they malign her, but I caught them actually in a despicable lie.
That's why I want to ask you about the title of the book itself. You call it Unmasking Mother Teresa's Critics. The word unmasking suggests that they know they're frauds.
That's correct. And I looked at this and I said, wait a minute now. Just take that one example there. I said, well, you lie. We all make mistakes. You can't lie unless you know the truth. I'm accusing the Serge Larrivée and the other professors at Ottawa and Montreal of lying. Now, here's an example. They said, by the way, they wrote their book and about Mother Teresa, never interviewed a single person who the Sisters of Charity ever, Missionaries of Charity ever helped. They never interviewed one of the sisters. They just did this from afar. Okay. Now they write this and they say that the unsanitary conditions were incredible, and they cited Dr. Robin Fox, who testified to that.
And oh, totally twisted his report.
Well, I would say more than twisted. We've seen hyperbole and spinning. I'm saying that it's a palpable lie because Fox commended them.
Right.
And I had to pay for another service to get this. I hunted this stuff down. And the more I found out about it, I said, my God, you know, if you want to bring up any shortcomings of anybody, go ahead. If you want to say, well, she didn't do enough or something like that, that's okay. When you have to lie about somebody, and getting back to your point, you know, unmasking, did they know what they're doing? I mean, Christopher Hitchens was personally pro-life, yet he slammed her for being pro-life. So that kind of hypocrisy has to be demonstrated. And I went through all the major critics of Mother Teresa, and I found two common denominators in all of them. Number one, this is easy for the listener to understand, militant atheist. The second one may not be as obvious, socialist, hardcore leftist. Now, why would it? You can be an atheist and not be against Mother Teresa. And there are,
right.
I even mentioned.
Which you cite. You cite a few.
Absolutely. And matter of fact, you could be a socialist and not be against Mother Teresa.
In fact, you cite one ex-Catholic abortion rights activist who was totally praising of her and her work.
Yes, Celeste Owen Jones, unlike the Canadians, unlike Christopher Hitchens and others who have written about Mother Teresa, never met any of the nuns or the people whom they helped. Celeste Owen Jones, the listeners should know, she's an ex-Catholic. She's pro-abortion. And yet she worked with Mother Teresa and said she'd never seen anybody work like this to help the destitute as courageously as Mother Teresa. And she attributed Mother Teresa's love for the people, the lepers, the AIDS patients, the children who are malnourished, to her pro-life position.
Yeah. Which she did not criticize.
Yeah. I mean, these people have to be unmasked because, getting back to the thing on the socialist end of it here, look, what they're saying is this, and if you have to read this thing carefully, to what they say, they say they're in favor of helping the poor. Okay, let's just say that I'm not going to question that.
Right.
Why would they be against Mother Teresa? Not just simply because she's grounded in Jesus, but because their idea of helping the dispossessed is that that's the job of the state, state-run programs. And any kind of private, voluntary, especially religious, faith-based outreach program to the poor is actually an obstacle, a deterrent, as they see it, to the state doing its dutiful job. It's strange, it's bizarre, but that's what they believe.
Well, they also insinuate that she was, because from a Christian point of view, suffering is redemptive.
Right.
That she was actually trying to perpetuate the right. suffering of the poor.
Yes, and the Canadians were particularly vicious on that. As I pointed out, well, if you don't believe in God and you don't believe in redemptive suffering, you don't believe in redemption, obviously you can have a hard time trying to understand this. But you know what's strange? Let's just say you're an atheist, okay, and you don't understand the Catholic understanding of redemptive suffering, which is James Hitchcock has said. He's a friend of both of ours,
yes.
great historian. He said it's probably the most radical idea in history, and I would agree with him on that. Let's say you don't understand it. Aren't the students told on the college campuses every single day that if you want to understand other cultures and aboriginal groups, and they found, a group of 10 people off the South China Seas, that we have to practice what Weber called Verstehen, a sympathetic understanding, that you have to get inside the mind of somebody else, that you don't take your own views and then impose them. Why is it when it comes to the Catholic Church, they just throw that out? They just throw that out.
As you point out, the criticism aimed at Native American religion would have immediately been slapped down.
Absolutely. You'd be called a bigot. There's no question to be run off the campuses as a microaggression. I just read that the State University of New York in Binghamton now has a course on white privilege. And if you don't think whites are privileged, then you are considered uneducated. In order to pass the course, you have to understand that white people are privileged. Now, I just want to know one thing. If there's a white kid whose father is a dishwasher, and he's sitting next to Sasha and Malia in the classroom, is he supposed to apologize to Sasha and Malia because he's privileged?
Right. I want our listeners to know that your book, again, entitled Unmasking Mother Teresa's Critics, from Sophia Press, is also really a kind of wonderful introduction to her life, her work, and her spirituality. I mean, you don't spend all your time answering the critics. You also let the reader know who she was, how she came into prominence in the first place. Would you mind telling that story? Because I didn't really know it.
And there are great biographies written by Chawla and Sprink, and I wanted to do that for the reader so that you just didn't have Bill Donahue versus Christopher Hitchens. I mean, it's in there, obviously. But, you know, I wanted to demonstrate the yeoman work. For example, one of the criticisms of her has been that, well, she, you know, a lot of these people died in her presence and they didn't get to the hospitals. Well, first of all, the mortality rate dropped precipitously from the 1960s up until right today as a result of their care and getting these people to the hospitals when they needed to be. Secondly, there's a difference between a hospice and a hospital. They both have their legitimate roles in our society. I guess if you're just a coarse atheist, maybe you won't understand what it's like to be loved in your dying days. And that's what Mother Teresa was able to provide, to comfort the dying, to set up leprosy settlements and asylums when nobody else wanted them, to pick up the refuse, the human refuse that the hospitals in Calcutta said we can't deal with. We've got to get rid of these people. We're talking about children who survived an abortion. We're talking about people who have all kinds of diseases. And instead of cheering her and applauding her, we have these atheists like Dr. Arup Chatterjee from Calcutta. He says, well, she gave my city, my hometown of Calcutta, a bad name, as if Mother Teresa created the destitute so that she could make this guy look bad. I mean, sometimes the logic is just so far gone, it's hard to believe.
Well, you can tell from your account, the quotes you pull out of these critics' books, is that their motivation is not to get at the truth about Mother Teresa. Their motivation is to try to discredit the woman who you say on the very last paragraph of your book became the most admired woman of the 20th century.
Yes, I mean, she actually outdid Martin Luther King, John Paul II, Billy Graham, and other wonderful people, all religious people, interestingly. Sure, didn't make the list. You know, Miley Cyrus didn't make the list. The American people don't admire those kind of people. But, you know, this idea of the agenda, it started with Arup Chatterjee, the Indian physician from Calcutta, who I mentioned, and he was looking around for some help on this, and somebody referenced Hitchens, who had moved to New York, and the two of them teamed together. Now, again, they had something in common, which later, in 2013, the Canadians demonstrated. They did this, in their case, they didn't write a journal article. They did a documentary on Mother Teresa. Now, if you're going to do a documentary on a serious person, a woman who's loved the whole world over by people who have no faith whatsoever, and you want to be critical of her, I say, yes, go ahead. Because it's a free speech and have the evidence. If you're going to do a story on a person, wouldn't you want to maybe talk to one of the people who worked with her? Wouldn't you want to talk to some of the people?
Well, that's kind of standard journalistic and research practice.
Yeah. Wouldn't you want to talk to the people whom she served, what they thought of the care? Nobody bothered one bit because that was not part of their agenda. Their agenda was to get Mother Teresa. And, you know, one of the things that they hate about her, and this is also true of the Canadians, all these people regard altruism as a myth. And what I think really, if you scratch it just a little bit, what the underbelly of that is, they don't like the ideas of altruism because typically altruism gets to the question of religion.
Is that true of Christopher Hitchens as well?
Oh, absolutely. That's why he was a statist. No question about it. Look, there was a book by two sociologists, non-believing Jews, Pearl and Samuel Oliner, called The Altruistic Personality. And they found out that the people who were the most likely, those Christians who were the most, I shouldn't say Christians are giving away, those people who were the most likely to risk their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust were believing Christians, Catholics even more than Protestants. And so when you talk that when they talk about altruism, it's very difficult to talk about the subject without talking about people of faith, of strong faith. And that's what bothers these people. They don't believe. They believe the almost Ayn Randian kind of thing that we're all just self-interested beings, and that's why the state has to come in there and do the job.
I'm talking to Bill Donahue about his book on Mother Teresa. Bill, that reminds me of a book I was forced to read in graduate school by a philosopher named Thomas Nagel, a very big book at the time, called The Possibility of Altruism. And it's only at this moment that I put together what you just said with the kind of ideas that were floating around in the academy when I was going to school.
Well, here you take the owners, they're atheists, they love altruism. They said, my God, if I were a Jew and if back in, you know, turn the clock back and I'm in Nazi Germany, I would want a nun or a priest to come, and more than anybody else, because they're the ones most likely to give of themselves. And what Nagel's talking about as well. But that's seen as a threat, altruism, not to anybody who happens to be a non-believer, but to those people.
Or certainly not to the poor in Calcutta.
Well, isn't that the strange thing about it as well? And their idea of helping the poor is to have more abortions. Hitchens said it. The Canadians said it. They faulted her, Mother Teresa, for being pro-life. You know, according to their logic, if we just practiced infanticide and killed everybody who's 1, 2, or 3 years of age, we'd have that many less mouths to feed.
But you bring up China as the rebuttal of that.
Oh, China is the classic case. The highest female suicide rate in the world is in China. That's because up until recently,
and plenty of poverty,
forced to abort their children,
and plenty of poverty.
Yes, yeah. If that's the way we get rid of poverty, we're in trouble. You talk about slippery slope.
Mao Zedong, as you say, killed 75 million of his own
in
one way or another. That was his way of dealing with it.
I guess, that's one way of getting rid of the population problem. Certainly gets rid of a lot of poverty.
Tell a story about Malcolm Muggeridge, because I really didn't know all that story too well. You open your book with it.
Right. Here's one of the great things about Mother Teresa. This is a humble woman who never sought the limelight. I mean, we live in a world of celebrity culture where everybody is selfies on the phones and, you know, look at me and what I'm doing and the bloggers. Everybody thinks they're the equal of somebody who's a real scholar. And here we have this woman who just quietly went about her life trying to tend to the poor, felt a call within a call, a vocation from Jesus to go and help the poor. And she does it very quietly. Well, the BBC learned of her, and they said, you know, this guy Muggeridge, who at that time wasn't a believer, later became an Episcopalian, then became a Catholic, they said, why don't you do a segment on our show, kind of a 60-minute thing, on this woman, Mother Teresa. She sounds very unusual. He said, all right, I'll do it. And then he says, you know, she's kind of unimpressive and on the camera, and I don't know if this is going to work. Well, it's because she was so incredibly, spectacularly genuine and authentic that she was able to capture not just the people in the studio, but then when it was shown on TV. Well, it wasn't long after we had this hero, Mother Teresa, introduced to the British audience and then later to the rest of the world, that people like Chatterjee and Hitchens and others who have this animus against religion, and let's face it, their animus is against us. It's against Catholicism. I'm sitting here talking to you right now, looking at the World Trade Center. We have won. We had towers at one point. When they went down, we know who did that. It wasn't Catholics screaming Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, all right? And yet, it wasn't radical Muslims who were blamed for that. After 9/11, we went to this atheist phase led by Hitchens and Dawkins and others, and they wound up attacking us. Somehow, Catholics always get it in the end. We're always the big, fat, rich target. I guess it's a backhanded compliment. But, Muggeridge discovered Mother Teresa.
And didn't he go back very far? Didn't he even cover the Russian Revolution? Does he go back that far?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right.
This is the man who saw what was going on under Stalin.
Right, and he was a communist sympathizer, but he completely changed his mind, correct?
Right. Unlike Walter Duranty, who was the journalist by the New York Times, who was in the Soviet Union watching the genocide, watching the world's first man-made famine in the Ukraine, and they asked him about it later, why didn't you say what Muggeridge did? I mean, Muggeridge was a communist sympathizer, but he saw what was happening, he reported back. Well, you know, the idea is, you know, revolutions do go through some problematic stages, but eventually, you know, it'll get better. Well, Eric Hobsbawm, the Marxist from England, who died a few years back, they asked him, would you still have defended the communist revolution knowing what you know now, that tens of millions of people, actually hundreds of millions of people, were killed? And he said, yes, I would. So, these are barbarian intellectuals.
And Muggeridge actually became a Christian a Catholic Christian because of Mother Teresa, isn't that
absolutely
right?
Absolutely. First he converted to he became an Anglican. He's an Englishman, that's understandable. But eventually he made his migration over to the Catholic Church.
And he wrote several volumes of memoirs that described his journey. Did he not?
Yes, he did. And he's a very famous person, maybe not as much in the United States. I opened the book with him precisely because I think if you really want to understand why do we even know who Mother Teresa is, you gotta begin with Malcolm Muggeridge.
Now, why did, as you show in your book, there was this kind of spark lit by the emergence of Mother Teresa, which erupted pretty quickly, and the critics started to pounce on her. What is your understanding of why this was set off so quickly?
Well, let's take a look at the timeline on this thing. Hitchens doesn't really strike and Chatterjee until the mid-90s, okay? That's right after Muggeridge basically sees
the... He does the documentary.
So so he writes this this book, which I told him to his face on several times, and not talking behind his back now. Poor Christopher passed away in December.
Yeah, you debated him over and over again. I remember you telling me about it at the time.
Oh yeah, we had many, we had formal debates. We had a lot of shootouts.
You beat him up pretty good. I remember.
There was even, I'm not going to mention, a Catholic public figure who went up to Hitchens and apologized to him because I was too rough on him. I guess the next time I go into debate, I'll be a wallflower.
Well, you know, I only encountered him a couple of times socially, and we had good conversations about novels and so forth. He struck me as a guy capable of being kind and nice. Am I wrong?
We had a number of exchanges in that vein. He thanked me profusely and was stunned that I wrote a letter to the editor, which they published in Vanity Fair, one of the publications he wrote for, commending him for his pro-life position.
Was he truly pro-life?
Pardon me?
Was he truly pro-life?
Yes, he was. But
as his brother is today.
Yes, exactly. And for him, it was just simply a matter of, which is what I agree with too, is biology 101. I love it when people say, "Well, the Catholic Church, that's their religious." No. Science and religion come together on this question of the beginning of life. Life doesn't begin a week after conception. Doesn't begin after you're born. It begins at conception. Okay, all the DNA properties that make you a human being are there at that point. And so the Catholic Church is fully in command with science, way ahead of science, as far as I'm concerned. But Christopher knew this. He commended me for that. And he also was not naive about who the threat was in the Middle East. It's not the Jews. It's the Muslims, the radical Muslims. He was very much on to the fact that Islamofascism is a great threat to the Western world. So we agreed on those two things very strongly. We also like to have a drink, but unfortunately, Christopher didn't use the break that God gave us to.
No, I was on a plane once when he was pretty much out of his mind.
But you know, the thing is about him, he was a great debater. He was quick. He was fun to debate. We did have some light moments. I do think he was a kind of a miserably unhappy man most of his life. He was promiscuous with his sexual life. He was promiscuous with tobacco. Promiscuous with alcohol. Maybe that accounts for the fact that his attack on Mother Teresa, which is 98 pages, not a single endnote, not a single footnote, no attribution, no bibliography, nothing. Which is why I had to tell him to his face, Christopher, I'd have to give you an F if you were my college student. If you want to take on the world's most famous person as an altruist and you want to try to take her down, well, then at least you have to have the evidence. I actually have more footnotes in my little book than I have pages.
I'd give you an A for your book.
He didn't have any.
I'd give you an A. You've got 134 footnotes in a 114-page book.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, as I read, I use pencil markings whenever I read a book, just in case my kids or my grandkids ever want to come back and read them. I got pencil marks on every page.
Well,
it
was fun to write because, I say, the fun thing about it is that unlike every other book I've written, which I had planned to do. This, I had no intention of writing a book until
this one. This one seems a bit inspired, Bill. Not, do you mind me saying that? It seems
inspired
by it. It's a combination of anger toward the critics, but also tremendous admiration for Mother Teresa.
Well, as I've been saying to people interviewing about the book, I loved her before I wrote the book. I love her more after I wrote the book.
Well, I love her more after reading your book. I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking to Bill Donahue, president of the Catholic League, very well known on television all the time, always a breath of fresh air. The book is entitled Unmasking Mother Teresa's Critics. And by the way, everybody, there's no H in Mother Teresa, okay? Let's get rid of the H in Mother Teresa. And it's published by Sophia Institute Press, and you can go to the Sophia Institute website and buy it directly from them, and they'll make more money, which they definitely deserve. Or you can order it online, or I'm sure this book made it to bookstores, Bill.
I'm not sure. I know Barnes & Noble picked it up. You can buy it through Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Sophia, whether they picked it up in the book. So that's a little bit trickier now when you get into the distribution on that kind of stuff. But, you know, so many people buy their books online these days. All the familiar sites have it.
We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk to Bill Donahue more about his, not just his defense of Mother Teresa, but his account of her sanctity, because we know she'll be officially declared a saint by the Catholic Church in a matter of a week. We'll be right back after this short message.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me September 23rd through 25th at the Theology of the Body Congress in Southern California. We'll be joining parish leaders, clergy, religious, international experts, and other enthusiasts for St. John Paul II's teaching on the beauty of human love. Love, mercy, and the gift of the family is the gift to help your family through today's marital and gender confusion. You can learn more by going to tobcongress.com. That's tobcongress.com.
As Christians, we are taught that what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. And in Ephesians, it reads, "No bad word should come from your mouth, but only what is good and edifying, that it may give grace to those who hear." If you want to have a clean mouth without having to use soap, start by cleansing the heart. Think back to those various points in life when the anger that festered inside eventually percolated up and right out of your mouth with words of hate for people who have hurt you, offended you, lied to you, used you, abused you, stole from you, or perhaps altered your life forever. When we hold on to the past, we cloud the love of Jesus Christ, and what emerges is the pain inflicted on us from mankind. If you find yourself cursing, spewing hateful words about others, or often negative about life, then close your mouth and open your heart. Fill it with the love of our Lord and let His words emerge from your mouth. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the communication evangelist.
Hi, Tom Lowy here, Development Director for Ave Maria Radio. Our fall membership drive is September 6th through the 9th this year. That's the week of Labor Day, and we really need volunteers to make this drive successful. If you can spare a couple of hours during any of the days of the drive, that's September 6th through the 9th, give us a call at 877-288-1077 or email our volunteer director, Cheryl, by going to volunteer@avemariaradio.net.
I'm back with Bill Donahue, the president of the Catholic League, and we're talking about his new book on Mother Teresa. And Raymond Arroyo, our mutual friend, Anita Tien, provides the blurb, the main blurb. Russell Shaw is also there, another friend. But Raymond says, Mother Teresa's detractors have met their match. And by the way, I'll amen that. You talk in depth about the Canadians and their attack. What prompted that, and has it had any influence at all? Has it changed anybody's mind about Mother Teresa?
It did not get wide distribution. It was never translated. You can go onto the internet. It's still not translated. I had to pay $3,000 to somebody to get it translated. So that's one of the reasons why the lack of dissemination showed it had very little effect. I was stunned that in a refereed journal that this would be published. In all likelihood, it wouldn't be published in this country. It doesn't speak well for scholarship in Canada that this incredible diatribe is what it is, which it also contains lies, as I pointed out, would ever be published. Now, why do they do it? They make it very clear. They hate the idea of altruism. They say it's a total myth. It's not good for people to believe this way. They actually, I mean, they're at least in one sense, they're honest. They came right out. If you read the article, it's fairly, not too long, but it's not a couple pages. In the article, I'm looking for to get to this question of their motive. Why would they do this? And it's there. They fault her for not engaging in direct intervention. They wanted her to be a Saul Alinsky crusader. They wanted the community organizer type, get into the streets, get the people agitated. I mean, Mother Teresa was never there to say, well, I believe in the structural causes of poverty, or I believe in the cultural causes of poverty. Why we have poverty, all kinds of reasons, that's for the intellectuals, had nothing to do with it. She's not there as a magic wand to get rid of poverty. She's simply saying, they're here. What are we going to do about it? And as she often said, if you want to help the poor, it must cost you. That's good Catholic social teaching. In other words, there's got to be a personal relationship between the giver and the person whom they're helping. Not writing a check, or even worse, asking the government to pick the pocket of the taxpayer to write a check for Uncle Sam so that we can have more programs which help out the middle class who supervise and bureaucratize the poor. She was there to say, no, you've got to work with these people. You've got to pick them up. You've got to take them up when they don't have elevators, up the stairs. You've got to have tend to the lepers, tend to the AIDS patients. That's where real love comes through.
Well, you know, you have that wonderful quote that or comment she made to Margaret Thatcher when Thatcher was bragging about the welfare system. You go ahead, tell our listeners what she said to Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, and of course she's criticized for even being consorting with Margaret Thatcher, as well as Rudy Giuliani, Ronald Reagan. These people are crazy. Anyhow, she meets Margaret Thatcher, who's a great world leader, of course, but, you know, Thatcher was going to say to her, listen, we care about the poor in Britain. We're not heartless. We have a lot of good programs and welfare programs, and Mother Teresa's listening, and she said, yes, but do you have love?
Yes.
Do you have love? See, nothing wrong with getting an MSW, a master's in social work. Nothing wrong with that. A lot of my students went on to that. But
by the way, you must remember President Bush, George W. Bush, saying all the time, the government cannot love. The government cannot love.
He said that. And that has to be taken a leaf right out of Mother Teresa's book, because that's what she's saying. You can't get this learned in some licensure. You can't get this as a credential in a master's degree program. It's something that's interior. You either have it or you don't have it. And that's where her selflessness comes through, her altruism. She wasn't looking for any reciprocity. Everything she ever got in terms of money, some despots gave her money. Yeah, what did she do? Take a fast weekend in Atlantic City? I mean, every dime she ever got went back to the people whom she was helping out, the dispossessed, the destitute, whom nobody else wanted, the throwaways in our society. And you know what's so great about her, too? We always talk in our church sometimes and we get a little caught up in it, but, the pro-life wing and the social justice wing and so the tensions between them. She didn't straddle both. She was anchored in both. But I think this is really a more of a statement, an indictment for the social justice people who have shown very little interest in pro-life. If you're pro-life, yes, you should be committed to the poor and the needy, as Mother Teresa was. But the reason why a lot of people have had a problem with her, as well as Mother Angelica, by the way, another great woman, is because they're Orthodox in their beliefs. The ordination is for males. Life begins at conception. Whoa, that sets off the social justice people, because while I'm not saying they're pro-abortion, they've shown very little interest in being involved in the cause of the pro-life campaign. And when it comes to a lot of the teachings of sexuality in the Catholic Church, it gives them pause, if not being totally professed dissidents.
Now, have you ever had a face-to-face encounter with Mother Teresa's critics other than Christopher Hitchens?
I've debated some of them on TV, and I've had some a lot of exchanges. I'm trying to think face-to-face. There aren't too many. Certainly nobody the stature of Hitchens. I think it was when the Canadians came in 2013, three professors, that kind of put me over the top. There have been others, Hemley Gonzalez, there's still Chatterjee. You get this Hemet Mehta and all these people, the humanists and the like. And, of course, let's not forget, we're not just talking here. One of the reasons I wrote this book to come out at this time, it's not because you have another Christopher Hitchens going to pop up next week. It's because the media, they're more than just contrarians. The drumbeat will begin next week because it's a dead news cycle, the run-up to Labor Day. Clinton and Trump can't carry every day. And eventually they're going to get around to the canonization on the Sunday of Labor Day weekend, September the 4th. And you know it's going to come out. Well, she may have been loved by millions, but she still had her detractors. And then they will give out, they'll trot out the same unsubstantiated opinions of Hitchens and the others. So I wrote this in anticipation of media hit jobs, and so that I could be there to knock down these myths.
Have you started hearing from any of the news shows booking you for the canonization?
No, and right now it's all been people who are on our side. But I know the media, they're last-minute Charlies on a lot of this stuff. I do think that Monday and Tuesday, if they want to get somebody even, a lot of times they'll tape things in advance, of course, for a big holiday weekend, last real weekend of the summer. They may tap me next week on that. But I'm getting lots of hits, but the hits are on people who want to hear about who the critics are, but are people like yourself who don't need to be persuaded in terms of the greatness of Mother Teresa. Next week, hopefully, I'll get a chance on that. But, you know, quite frankly, who wants to debate me on this?
I don't think anybody should. Now, but you know that CNN or MSNBC
yep.
is going to trot out these very guys that you take apart in your book.
Yes. If I can't force my way on TV... if they don't want to have me on TV, we're going to be watching this very closely, and I'll be able to respond at least and getting the word out through our own websites and other mediums and opportunities. That I have other things lined up next week with Cardinal Dolan's radio and TV show and others. If they want to strike, I'll be here.
Do you predict they will bring these very people on the show?
I don't know that they'll bring them on because there isn't anybody quite of the stature of Hitchens. I do think they'll rehash some of the criticisms of her. And they'll begin to question, you know, oh, well, she had her dark moments. Did she really believe?
Oh, let's talk of, yes.
Yeah.
We all remember a number of years ago when her letters were published. And, again, they were published by... the priest who knew her prior.
Yeah.
And they were very profoundly spiritual letters about her dark nights of the soul. And yet you tell the story of how Time magazine turned that completely against her. Would you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, Father Brian, first of all, if she didn't believe in God, why would her postulator, the person who's promoting her cause, publish this?
Yeah.
He was just simply being honest about it. Lots of saints have gone through their difficult patches. They don't stop believing in Jesus. They may not feel that palpable presence the way they once did. And that might be disturbing to them, but they are daily communicants. Certainly Mother Teresa was. Hitchens and I had it out on that as well, the distinction between believing and feeling. He didn't want
to... Well, yeah, go into that, because I think that's the core of the refutation, because she describes in her letters how she doesn't feel Jesus' presence anymore in the Eucharist. But you have a good explanation at some length about why that does not designate a loss of faith, or it doesn't designate a lack of belief at all. In fact, you even cite one person who watched her taking the Eucharist and how her face was luminous.
She was the most reverential person as a communicant, and she did it on a daily basis. And look, early in her career, she felt Jesus speak to her, and that you must go to leave the Sisters Loretto. You've got to go and tend to the poor, and she chose Calcutta. She didn't quite get that same sense. Now, some people have speculated, interestingly, that it was about the time when a lot of people are questioning Pius the 12th after he died in 58. I don't know how much people want to put stock in that, as to why these attacks come about and people feel this way. But we do know that she didn't feel quite that same sense, and that was troubling to her because she did it one time. But she never stopped believing in Jesus. Now, for Hitchens, who was already predisposed to cutting her down, he went on TV and Hardball, Chris Matthews and me, trying to say, oh, she gave up her belief in Jesus. I mean, he had to have known better. That if that were the case, then why didn't she just bolt and sign up with the humanist? Instead, it was the inspiration that allowed her to continue with her work with the destitute. And by the way, it was after that debate that Christopher had been pretty good in debating me, but he started to lose some traction with me. And this I didn't put in the book. I probably should have. But he died in 11. It was about a year or two before he died that he started out with his attacks again. It was Holy Week. And he was doing it on MSNBC. So MSNBC said to me, do you want to go on and debate him? I said, of course. I debate Christopher. I debate anybody. I don't care. So let's do it on Tuesday. And they said, well, they got back and said, well, he's busy on Tuesday. I said, what about Wednesday? Wednesday he's busy too. Okay, Thursday. And then they came back and they said, Hitchens said he'll debate you on Good Friday at 3 p.m.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, knowing that I wouldn't do it. So that's when it began to lose some traction. But look, people go through periods of doubt. They go through periods of, in this case here, not so much doubting the presence of Jesus, but saying, you know, did I get that same tangible sense of direction, that feeling from God? Well, you know, lots of great saints have gone through this kind of situation. But, you know, that's fodder, obviously, for those people. They don't want to believe. They didn't believe in the miracles of these people, which they went through. I mean, but if you've come to the conclusion that redemptive suffering is, as the Canadians say, they basically say that's people who are insane believe that. If you've come to the conclusion there's no such thing as Jesus, no such thing as redemptive suffering, no such thing as redemption, there's no such thing as altruism, and you see this woman heralded by people all over the world, you say to yourself, wow, this woman needs to be taken down a few notches. And if you're a hardcore socialist and you think that's the job of the state to take care of the poor, and you're a hardcore atheist and you don't like anybody who shows a religious informed altruism, wow, she's the big package. If you can take her down, then, you know, you've really taken a deep shot at Catholicism. But, you know, the ones that are out there following Hitchens today, they're basically mimicking what he said, because it's the same old, same old.
One of the most remarkable things in your book is the chapter on where did the money go? Because I remember, you know, hearing the criticism about a mishandling of money or misuse of money, but as you show in your chapter, that's completely bogus.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got these guys like who went to prison, a publisher, Robert Maxwell in Britain, and Charles Keating, same as a loan guy in the United States. They had given her money. After she spent the money, on the poor.
Yes. And by the way, she never asked for money.
No, she never asked for money, but and she gave the money to the poor, and later it's found out that they had broken the law. But what is she supposed to do? Go into the stomach of the poor and try to get the food out? I mean, they never tell you that. They never tell you. Hitchens doesn't tell you. The Canadian scholars don't tell you that the money had already been spent. How in the world would you have moral culpability in that kind of situation? And, you know, if the world is full of despots and some of them give you some cash and you spend it on the poor, would the poor be better off if she didn't spend the money on them? I mean, what kind of a world do we live in of Snow White? She didn't go out there and make somebody poor and then take that money from the rich and then give it to them. No, she lived an ascetic lifestyle specifically because she did not want to be caught up in this game that some people do, and you become like the rich because you become so dependent on your donors. That's what's happened to many others. They kind of get bought off and co-opted. That was not going to happen to her. So what happens with that? Now she's criticized because she lived an ascetic life. A woman in Calcutta, an atheist, says she never was involved in the intellectual and cultural life of Calcutta.
Whoa.
Mother Teresa, the opera.
Right. You know, you make the point that when someone did get inside their bank accounts in India, they had $7 million. And you make the point that anybody involved in a big nonprofit would realize that's not a whole lot of money for the kind of scope her apostolate had.
$7 million is a joke. It's like 7 cents if you're running any kind of charity. And beyond that, these people say that she had secret bank accounts, as if the Canadians who wrote that have bank accounts that I can go into this afternoon. But beyond that, after they told us that the bank accounts of Mother Teresa were secret, on the very next page, they tell us how much money was in the secret bank account. I guess it was
right,
such a
right, thing. Exactly.
I mean, it's you have to wonder. Maybe nobody did read this article except for me.
Well, I think that, you know, again, this book is entitled Unmasking Mother Teresa's Critics by Bill Donahue, president of Catholic League, published by Sophia. I think this book will become instantly the go-to book for answering any arguments that are still sort of residual out there in the culture about her integrity. I mean, there's really nothing here that you haven't covered, and you've definitively refuted every single point they've made. And
well, that exactly was the point of the book. I wasn't going to skirt around here and say, well, let's see, now there's no evidence to support her on that one, so I'll cherry pick among the senior criticisms. No, I looked at all what's been written about her, all the critics, and I said, all right, there's about a half a dozen or more of these same kind of criticism. I'm going to look at every one of them individually, go through the care, where she got the money, the miracles, her dark nights, her alleged altruism, and the like, and see if there's anything to it. And then I find out that there's distortions, there's lies, that nobody bothers to interview the people she works with. They misrepresent what she's doing. She's running a hospice. She's not running some type of, you know, Sloan Kettering Center. I wanted to make sure that every major criticism that's ever been made about her was taken on directly.
I'm glad you mentioned her founding of the first AIDS hospital in New York City in Greenwich Village. But you also quote Mayor Ed Koch, who was evidently a big fan of hers.
That's right. And it's interesting that she didn't want to get – people don't want to give her credit for that either. In a previous book I had written, my editor said to me, are you sure that Mother Teresa was the first person to set up a hospice for AIDS patients in New York City? I don't believe it. I had to show them the evidence. And then they,
really?
Yeah. I mean, the hostility. But, she not only did that, but, then she was criticized in New York City. Here's another example of omission. They said that she was against public buildings in New York City having elevators to help people. And so how in the world were the handicapped and the homeless supposed to get up the stairs? What they didn't tell you is that she answered them by saying, why waste the money of the government when the sisters and I can take them up the stairs ourselves?
Well, I just, that sort of took my breath away, that detail.
Yeah.
I mean, these little ladies in white robes carrying crippled people up the stairs. Wow.
I mean, they took people who nobody else would tend to. These are our modern-day lepers, and she came to them. She wasn't making passing judgments on anything. I mean, she was not an ideologue whatsoever. But, you know, let me mention again about her pro-life position, because she stunned the Clintons at a prayer breakfast. She stunned the world in 1997 with the Nobel Prize when she received that. And she talked about how if a mother can kill her child, what's left? Anybody
right.
can kill anybody. That if you believe in peace, you must be against abortion. That set off Hitchens. That set off the Canadians. That set off all the other people, Gonzalez and Chatterjee and the like, that somehow abortion is not a violation of peace. It certainly is to the
people. Yeah, reminds me, immediately reminded me of Dostoevsky's famous line about if God doesn't exist, and anything is possible.
Well, there you go.
No, one of the most telling details in your book for me was where you talk about, well, you're actually quoting Catherine Spink's biography,
mm-hmm.
that at some point government workers in New Delhi asked her to train their social workers.
Yes.
But she turned them down.
She understood. She tried to get through to them that it's not just about, you know, some technical crafting of helping people and setting up dietary plans and the like. It's about love.
Yeah.
That's not something that you can get in these kinds of certificate programs. And if you want to learn from me, you know, she said, you know, watch us, come work with us, and some did, and she turned some people around on that. That biography by Chawla, Chawla, and he worked with her and saw what happened is stunning as well. It came out a number of years ago. But yeah, if you actually saw what she was doing and what she was trying to do in helping these people, and yet she could blame for anything. How about the one guy, Gonzalez, who worked with her for 2 weeks?
Yes.
One of the few who did. And he said that, these people, you know, they would soil themselves. They weren't in good physical health. And the nuns would say, well, give them fresh pants out of the washer and dryer. And he said, no, that was the wrong thing. They should have put diapers on them.
And that a nun didn't move fast enough when somebody called her.
Yeah. And then he said, because the nun didn't move fast enough, that she was, quote, evil.
That kind of took my breath away.
I mean, it did mine too, which is why I said I got to put this in the book. I can't believe what I'm reading here. This actually, I got to make sure that this gets into the book, because you're not now saying, well, you know, I would have done things a little bit differently. And that's why I say everybody has shortcomings. One could say instead of the powdered milk, you use something else. There's another criticism and the like. Let's say there's a legitimate argument there. We're talking here now, people making the leap, that because you disagreed with my way of tending to the needy, that therefore you're evil. See, that blows out the whole argument.
Yeah,
that's how we know what we're dealing with.
Bill Donahue, we have 2 minutes left. What are your thoughts about sanctity attracting this kind of hatred? Do you think that's a pattern in the history of the saints?
I think that wherever you see the face of Jesus, as you do in Mother Teresa, you're going to see Satan. I think that's one of the lessons we get from our church, that Satan doesn't like the good. And if you see someone like her, she has to be destroyed, or at least try to destroy her. And I'm not saying that these critics who I've been talking about are all possessed. That's not for me to say. I don't know that. I am saying that Satan does work through people. And there's evil in the world. And to try and destroy someone like her is something so mind-boggling, and yet there's more than just a few, and many of them are intellectuals. So you have to wonder, you know, what's going on here in the world. But where you see great good, you're going to see great evil. I think that's one of the lessons of Christianity.
Bill Donahue, I want to thank you for being on Church and Culture today, and I want our listeners to buy your book. It's entitled Unmasking Mother Teresa's Critics. That's, again, Teresa with no H. Let's get rid of that. And it's published by Sophia Press, Sophia Institute Press, and their website is www.sophiainstitute.com. Bill, thank you for doing this. I think it's a great gift to the church, and especially now that we're only a few days away from her official canonization. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you. Keep up the great work, and thanks for this opportunity to discuss this wonderful woman.
Thank you, and for all you listening, we're going to have a short break and come back with another great guest. Not quite as great as Bill, but very good.
A small fraction of 60 million babies killed by abortion are actually buried in human cemeteries, the only act of charity ever shown to them. Concentration camp survivor Elie Wiesel said, "To forget murder victims is to kill them twice. Honor the victims of abortion." Services are planned at graves of aborted babies in Michigan. The National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Babies is Saturday, September 10th. See locations and times at ProLifeSociety.com.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. Join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's talk radio where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. For our program this week, we have a very special talk we just recorded. Our speaker is Boston College Professor of Philosophy Peter Kraft. With a pro-euthanasia and pro-abortion presidential candidate and a pro-abortion governor who is backing a state proposal that allows for the virtual unrestricted killing of embryos for their stem cells, Christians have to be informed. We have to unmask the purposely clouded issues being put forth through a $20 million plus advertising campaign. We have to know the truth, and we have to vote according to our faith. Dr. Peter Kraft is a very informed and eloquent teacher who is also a convert to the faith. He'll be addressing the topic of voting as an informed Catholic. This is not a program to be missed. So you're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Won't you join us for a talk by one of the foremost Christian teachers in the world today, Dr. Peter Kraft, teaching on voting as a Catholic? Dr. Kraft will be introduced by Father John Ricardo. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting on the Mind of Christ on Ave Maria Radio.
Do children have a special insight? I'm Dr. Ray. Have you noticed a trend going on nowadays in the pop culture media? That is the idea of asking children what they think about complex social and moral issues. You've seen them in the major magazines, the kids section, where they go up to 15-year-olds and ask, "What do you think about going steady? What do you think about sex before marriage?" And they give the kids a credibility that they don't deserve. These are children. We, the adults, are the ones, I thought, as I look back over history, are responsible for raising children to teach them morals. But now our pop media says, no, the children have their own insights. Recently I heard on the radio a commentator, a news person, talking about the problems in a large local school district. And you know the lead-in line of this show? The children from the school district will talk about what's really going on. Children don't have a special insight. They've got a kid insight, and sometimes that's helpful. And sometimes they can give us good feedback about our own conduct, and it's always good, I think, to listen to them. But in terms of morals, in terms of continual conduct to being a better person, no, the insights have to come from the parents, the older people. I think that's the way God designed it. I'm Dr. Ray.
Fire on the Earth's Peter Herbeck on the diminishing influence of God on our culture and ultimately in us.
One of the reasons why the church today is not having the impact it can have and should have is we've accommodated too much to the culture. Sunday's just become another day. The whole culture has just sort of transformed.